Good day, podcast listeners, and it's another Thomas Jefferson Hour listener question show.
That was good. We started with this handwritten letter, a wonderful letter that someone wrote to us saying that
we need his name one more time.
We have shaped his life.
Well, I don't know about
I'm just going by what he said. I mean, I'm sure it's
Well,
not
he
true.
Said some very nice things, but do you still have his letter in front
Jeffrey
of you?
Jeffrey Butler of Greensboro, North Carolina,
Way
four
to go,
pages.
Jeffrey. Thanks a lot.
Really good. He talks about remember we recommended the book Liberty's First Crisis?
Do you ever write like, you know, you'll read a story or you'll read a book or and you're impressed by it and it leaves a mark on you. Do you ever sit down and write the author?
Yes.
Do you?
It's hard to get to them sometimes.
You know, I rarely do that. There's a couple of times I've been inspired to, but I want this guy to know we got his letter. And it really made our day.
You know, David, as somebody who's written books and often feels like you issue them into the world without any known response, when somebody writes to me and says what something that I've written has meant to them, it's not only makes my day. In some sense, it makes you go on and continue to do this sort of work.
It makes me work harder.
Yeah, it does. And so
it does.
I do write to authors, and I often get wonderful responses from them because, you know, it sounds crazy, but there's almost nothing more lonely than being a writer because you write this stuff and then off it goes and you think, hey, you think your mother's going to read it and your closest friends are going to read it, and they don't.
I want to talk a little bit, just quickly, if we can, about some of the shows that are coming up, what we've got planned. You and I both have sort of confessed to each other how we're immersing ourselves. There's so much new stuff out about Jefferson.
Oh, my goodness.
And coming from all sorts of different places, and not all of it good, is see Clay's essay this week.
You know, you and I have talked for a long time about the problem of Jefferson and slavery, and it is a huge problem. There's no way around this. And some people think we dwell too much on it.
As you pointed out, the whole man theory.
It's amazing how quickly we rush to judgment. And by the way, one of those rushes to judgment, in my view, is about the Trump administration. I think it's way too early to know where this is headed.
Maybe, but
way too early. But it doesn't look good.
Yeah, well.
But it's way too early. You know, I'm inviting him to come to North Dakota. I want to take him to the Elkhorn Ranch, and I want him to realize what the great Theodore Roosevelt represents as an American hero. With some bombast, but with a deep, deep, deep understanding of history. Someone like Donald Trump, and there are millions like him, certainly hundreds of thousands, lose contact with life as it's lived in small villages where people really do struggle, where they pay their bills, they love this country, their children sign up for the armed forces, they believe in America's purposes. Maybe that's a little naive, but they have a deep, abiding rural patriotism. And these urban gazillionaires who go from exclusive club to exclusive restaurant to first class to private jet to resorts that are rented for them and them alone to their friends' estates in California and in Italy and elsewhere, they can't help but lose touch with life as it's actually lived in the world, in the United States. And people who go out and actually see it, and you know, Donald Trump said during the late days of the campaign that his life had been really touched by meeting actual Americans around the country. And I took that seriously. That was the most sincere thing that I heard him say during the campaign. But these people get detached, and they think that everyone gets to live like them, or they don't care about the way people actually have to live. And so I do think that every president should have to backpack through Europe without handlers. I think every president should have to take a loopy auto trip through 20 or 30 states and just stay in shag carpet motels and eat in little local breakfast places.
Oh, boy, are you setting yourself up.
For what?
Mr. Adams to walk in and slap you silly.
Adams would say what? Are you nuts?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Why would that be nuts?
I sympathize and hold your position completely.
I can see that, yeah.
No, I do. I do, absolutely. But there is a point of realism. And, you know, the worlds that we live in, we create for ourselves. And we are not usually want to leave those worlds.
Let me just say this much. We need to get to the show. But
yeah.
I've been spending a lot of time wandering through rural North Dakota. And often people have a lot on their mind and they have some rage. And it's not actually directed at me or what I'm doing. They just sort of want someone to listen to them for a change. And when they start talking, they often say things in a very snarky and overstated way. And I listen and I say, oh, I think I hear this. And no, I actually disagree with that, but I'm listening. And after they've gotten some things off their chests and they believe that they have actually been listened to, almost everybody calms down and apologizes a little for that outburst and says, you know, it's so refreshing to be able to be listened to.
That is the most valuable thing that I have learned from you as your perpetual pupil of Thomas Jefferson. Yeah. And from the wow. reading that I have done. No, I meant that in a nice way.
No, but I do believe that civility works.
That's right. And that leads to civil discourse and stuff. But
people need to be heard. They aren't heard.
I don't think it's entirely a product of the government and, you know, people's dissatisfaction with that. We're living in a time that humans are just not made for or used to yet.
So I've been giving these talks, my friend, and someone will ask a question and I give the most honest answer that I possibly can. Sometimes it expresses an honesty that my handlers are a little uncomfortable with, but the people will be listening and they'll be hearing blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. And then they'll say, wait a minute, did you just say, and they're like so surprised that they didn't get a PR answer, that they got an actual answer that wasn't necessarily heroic, that they're like, wow, I never expected to hear a real answer. So it makes you think, wow, think of that. We have all these town hall meetings where politicians trot out the talking points. Often citizens do too, of course. But you think, where is the authentic left in our culture? Where does anyone give an honest answer?
Not the left, the authentic that is left in our culture.
Right. Yeah. I mean, not left, right, center. It doesn't matter your politics. But people, I think, here's the answer. People are so hungry to be taken seriously.
Coming up in shows in the next few weeks, we're going to return to our Jefferson 101 series.
And we want to do one on Jefferson and Madison.
I really do. I'm getting fascinated by him.
And I've been reading Ron Chernow's biography of George Washington. It's outstanding.
Really?
You know, he has a famous biography of Hamilton. His Washington is great. And I want to do a program, David, on how the presidency was, in a sense, established by George Washington. He had to make a number of precedents. He didn't really know what to do, so he did his best. And he really changed the course of America's history by the way he chose to interpret his powers and privileges as the first president of the United States. It's a really fascinating thing to think about how this one great man, in a sense, annotated the Constitution to make it the instrument that we now enjoy.
We're pushing the boundaries for a podcast, Jinder. Why don't we take this? Why don't we take this over to the 1776 Club for just a little overtime?
All right, let's do. So join us now on the 1776 Club if you want to hear more of this patter.
And we hope you enjoy this week's show. Thanks so much.
Yeah, indeed.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Seated across from me now is the gentleman who portrays President Thomas Jefferson, the creator of the Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And last week, sir, we made a date to continue to answer some listener questions.
We get a good deal of mail and we want more. And the only way to ensure that that mail continues to come is to answer it. You know, people don't send letters when there's no reply. I've learned this the hard way at both ends of that equation. And so from time to time, we like to step back and catch up on our listener mail. We have some really rich letters.
We had one that we just touched on at the sort of at the end of last week's show. We were both sort of taken aback by this letter. You came in, and there it was, a handwritten letter. Forgive me, who was it from?
From Mr. Jeffrey Butler of Greensboro, North Carolina.
It was just a delightful letter. He was very, very kind to both of us and had some interesting points. Do you want to recap that?
Yeah, he addresses it to three people, Mrs. Jenkinson, Swenson, and Jefferson.
I think maybe we might want to reverse that order somehow.
He says, I'll only quote a small portion of it. It's a handwritten letter. It's legible. It's 4 pages long. It's really wonderfully generous to the Thomas Jefferson Hour and to you and to me. He says, I'm writing a letter of thanks and modest support. My profession is that of a teacher of English. Work has taken my wife and me to many different places over our career. The Jefferson Hour has accompanied us along the way. Your show has been a companion to me as I've lesson planned in Japan, hiked the mountains of Korea, and ridden on more buses, trains, and airplanes than I can easily recall. This is to say nothing of all the times you have helped me to pass the time as I have cleaned, cooked, and gardened. Thank you. And he goes on to talk about some of the specific ways in which the Jefferson Hour has helped him. He says, I think of your show as an ongoing lecture series. It is hard to enumerate all that I have learned, thanks to the Jefferson Hour, about American history, Jefferson to Theodore Roosevelt to J. Robert Oppenheimer. You've provided me the free education and the Enlightenment principles, which are the foundation of our republic and the civic duty, which we all share as Americans. And then he said, this past year, this I think is a refrain that many people might agree with, this past year came as a shock to me. I'm glad that I can count on you all as a safe haven in today's environment of sensationalism. While I may not agree with every perspective that you share, and I think, David, neither you nor I agree with every perspective that we share, I deeply respect the commitment to civil discourse. It seems to me that you embody the Jeffersonian principle that not every difference of opinion is a difference of principle. Thank you for that.
That bit at the, well, first off, I apologize for making you read all that. I could see you blushing.
I was a little there. It seems a little fulsome.
Not Jeffersonian to be, saying all these nice things about us, but it was a very kind letter. But that bit at the end about civil discourse, we've been through a lot in this country, and there are. I was watching an interview the other day with a former federal official who I respect his judgment, talking about how, shaking things up right now. It was Bob Gates.
Oh, and sure. Formerly the president of the University of Texas.
He was saying that it's good to shake some of these government institutions up from time to time because, it's needed. It's good to shake up, foreign policies from time to time because it's needed. At the same time, I think there are a lot of Americans and voters who are a little bit on the edge of how much it's been shaken up.
Well, there's shaking up and then there's just silly shaking. It's one thing to ask ourselves certain questions. Are the other countries in NATO pulling their weight? Are we giving too much American money and personnel to the defense of Europe? Should the United Nations be funded in a more equitable way? Should America, as its chief funding source, have greater say in the deliberations of that body? Are our trade agreements pursued on behalf of giant corporations, but in fact have a negative effect on labor in the United States and even on the pocketbooks of consumers? Should we be the policemen of the world? Are there agencies in Washington which are hidebound and rootbound and are not doing anything particularly useful and probably wouldn't pass muster if they had to be reinvented tomorrow? You can go into a lot of questions, and I think Donald Trump has successfully raised some of these questions. How should we protect our borders? Would a wall help at a time when there is a perception of really a rash of Islamic attacks on Western Europe and the United States? What's the proper response? Should there be some form of profiling, et cetera, et cetera? These are all questions that great nations ask.
And should.
And you can even be grateful that Donald Trump in 2016 and now 2017 is asking those questions. But there are responsible ways to ask those questions, and there are silly, childish, immature, reckless, ways to talk about those things, which damage lives and damage institutions that nations and individuals have given decades and even their lives to, that vilify judges or the judicial system per se. And so shaking things up doesn't necessarily mean shaking them up like your crazy uncle who comes and wrecks Thanksgiving. There are responsible ways to shake things up and to ask tough and unrelenting questions about American purposes and taxation and government.
If I can interject, I think Jefferson recognized the need for that. He's the one who said, tear up the Constitution every generation and write a new one. He recognized that we need to self-assess continually.
Of course.
And, you know, I think that maybe there's some truth to the argument that we become a bit complacent, and it's time to do that. On the other hand, I would have been shocked if you would have told me 18 months ago that people were going to go, you know what, professional politicians are maybe not such a bad thing. They know how it works.
Well, if you come to power by saying on day one, I'm going to repeal and replace the previous administration's health care plan, and I promise you, everyone, your rates are going down, and your rates don't go down. If you say that within the first X number of days, you're going to get us out of NAFTA or get us out of NATO or tell the Chinese that they are currency manipulators, and then when you come to power, you don't do those things, then this becomes one of two things. Either the campaign rhetoric has butted up against the realities of actually governing a third of a billion people in a complex world, or you didn't really mean those things after all, and so that's the very definition of demagoguery. Either you try to do the things you promised people you would do that they voted you into office to try to accomplish, or you say, oh my goodness, now that I'm here, I see how extremely complicated things are, and although I will try to make things better in healthcare and better in our trade agreements and better in our international security apparatus, I now see that this is going to be gradual. It's going to take mutually respectful negotiation with other countries, and that this is going to be a process of national recovery. There's no overnight answer of the kind that I promised on the stump. It seems to me that shaking up doesn't necessarily help a people. And meanwhile, it's created extremely widespread anxiety for people who need access to healthcare, for nations in Europe who fear Russian expansionism, etc.
So that would be some of the civil discourse that he was talking about in his letter, right?
This is civil discourse.
Yes, it is.
The question is, what is a responsible way to shake up a complacent and root-bound society?
Well, we need
we need that.
We need professionals in office that understand the system and how it works. But the danger of that, of course, is that we go back to Jefferson and talking about in this week's What Would Jefferson Do and the national debt and how money changes everything.
My concern, David, is shake it up to what end? So if – let's just say that Donald Trump's style, you know, bombastic – uninformed.
I've heard people compare him to Theodore Roosevelt and wondered how upset you would be to hear that.
Well, very upset because Roosevelt read a book a day.
Right.
But let's just say that Trump's seemingly crazy style of speaking without thinking it through and tweeting what appear to be highly irresponsible statements over and over and over again, statements that can be demonstrably proved to be untrue. Let's say that in 5 years, we're a better, leaner, smarter, more efficient, less financially burdened nation than we currently are. Maybe that was the right shakeup. In other words, can you imagine that his bombastic approach to all of these questions might in fact lead to a smarter, leaner, more efficient, more responsive, more democratic nation?
You're going to get some mail on that one.
I'm asking this question.
Yeah, but
why am I going to get mail? Because it either works or it doesn't, right?
Well, because I think that the partisan nature of politics in America now is so strong that anybody who is an anti-Trump voter is just going to fly off the handle at that.
I'm asking what brand of leadership this is and will it pay off? Will it actually drain the swamp, shake things up, improve America, in his terms, make America great again? I think those are fair questions for a civil student of American history to ask.
Agreed. And I go back to Jefferson and tear up the Constitution every generation. I think there's a better way to do it than the poor manners shown by some officials in government.
Well, Jefferson said, I like a little rebellion now and then, and we are in the midst of a top-down American rebellion.
Is it a rebellion, or is it just a reboot, or is it just a blip?
You know, we're so overstimulated and confused by the current events that are unfolding before our eyes that we're all sort of numb and exhausted. I think it's going to take a long time to sort all of this out.
Right now, sir, we need to take a short break. When we come back, we have a letter from Glenn Harris that is addressed to Mr. Jefferson.
Very well, then.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Seated across from me is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and we have a number of questions for you. And in fact, Clay, we have one in front of us now from Glenn Harris that is actually for Mr. Jefferson. Would you mind suiting up, spinning three times, and becoming Mr. Jefferson for a moment?
I will do my best, and here I go.
Do you need a moment?
Ready.
Good day, President Jefferson.
Good day to you, citizen.
I have a question from a listener. It has to do with the virtues of France and the French people. Now, I know you have made a famous statement about a citizen's... Help me, sir.
Every man's first country is, of course, his own, but every rational man's second country must be France.
He says, sir, I cannot fathom how you can hold a culture where 2% of the people live like gods on earth and 98% of the people are ground to dust to support the 2%. Your response?
I'm not certain that those percentages are quite accurate, but what I found in France was that of 20 millions of people, 19 million lived in abject poverty, with wants and desperation so great that it precipitated a national revolution, and that a tiny handful of people lived like gods on earth and lorded it over the great mass of people. I certainly agree with that assessment. So the question is, how then could I admire France? Well, I admired the French people, their amiability, their good humor, their wit, their civility. I said you could spend your entire life in France and never hear a single rude remark. They have taken the arts of etiquette to their highest pitch. They have rubbed off all of the little edges and roughnesses in the human character to produce a really extraordinary nation. And they also have that population over one of the most fertile landscapes and beautiful landscapes in the world. And so the problem of France is not the French people, and it's not the French fertility. The problem is the French economy, the French social structure, the French political system. And so what's needed is a series of reforms that will transform France from a despotism with Louis XVI as the king and Marie Antoinette as his haughty wife towards something like a parliamentary democracy in the short term, and then from a parliamentary democracy of the sort you see in Britain towards a greater republic of our variety. And I knew that this would take decades, maybe centuries, and that you don't want to jump from abject poverty and enslavement to democracy in one leap, because in doing so, you will almost certainly fail and bring about a military dictatorship, which, as you know, is precisely what happened when Napoleon rose in the Directory of France. And so I was a gradualist. I believed that France would become a nation like ours, with liberty and equality and fraternity and due process, and that the worst excesses of the church and the tax system and the absolutist monarchy would be ameliorated over time. But I hoped that this could happen in such a way that it wouldn't produce the kind of cataclysms that led to the Reign of Terror and then to the dictatorship of Bonaparte. So I don't think that this gentleman and I are in disagreement. I think maybe his view is, so what exactly did you admire? Because the civility that you're talking about is probably the civility of the aristocrats, the most successful of the French. I do remember that Voltaire said, in France, every man is either the hammer or the anvil. And I think this gentleman writing to us is saying, if most of the French people were the anvil, and you were spending your time, Mr. Jefferson, with those that could be called the hammer, in what sense were you reading French life accurately?
You do take his point, though, sir. There's a very famous story about you meeting a peasant woman during your travels in France and recognizing just how poor the French peasants were. Was there no middle class in France?
Not much at the time. That's what's so remarkable about our own revolution, that we produced the first middle class, really, that had any widespreadness on the spectrum of the social structure. There were a few rich people in America and a tiny number of truly poor people. But for the most part, we had produced the world's first very wide middle class, and that ensured our success. Well, in France, things had gotten dangerously out of resonance with natural law. And so that's what gave me hope. In other words, if the French people had been barbarous or savage or demonic or vicious, then I would have despaired of a better France. But they weren't. They were amiable and polite and civil and thoughtful and gay in many respects. And if the French countryside had been stony and infertile the way, say, New England is in the United States, I would have had greater concerns. But here you have a beautiful landform characterized by great fertility and a wonderful climate, and you have 20 million people, which is not too great a population. If they can, adjust their social order through careful gradualist reform to something like the principles that we hold so dear in America, then France is likely to become one of the most extraordinary nations on earth. I saw the potential of that. I don't think that I was stuck in aristocratic circles pretending that everything was fine, because, first of all, I didn't believe that. When I saw the way the French aristocrats behaved, not only with hauteur and a tremendous sense of presumption and class consciousness that looked down on most of the French people as almost subhuman, but also that these French aristocrats, however mannerly they were fatally attracted to wordplay and wit and frivolity, and they couldn't get serious even about the crisis that was just about to overwhelm them. And so I didn't take these salon circles of the most glittering aristocrats of France to be the future. I saw them as out of touch with the terrible poverty of the nation and the great rage that was percolating in the people. And they deserved, in some sense, to be overwhelmed by the revolution, because they couldn't focus on the truly grave concerns that any rational thinker in France would want to have attended to. So I don't think that I was just enjoying fine music, fine sculpture, the beauty of French women and the politeness of French salon culture.
Thank you, Mr. President. I know you have a busy schedule. Would you mind answering a couple of more questions? Do you have time, sir?
Now that I have powdered my hair.
Thank you, sir. We have a question from Ethan Pope. He writes, I believe that to know the mind of Jefferson, you must know what he knew. I have very little exposure to the classics, so I would like to know what books you, sir, read to develop your understanding of the classical period of philosophers.
Oh, my. What a question. It's the kind of question that one most wants to be asked. I don't think that I enjoyed anything in my life more than making lists of books for young men to read. This happened many times, and I was always happiest when I could direct the reading of a promising young man in my district. Meriwether Lewis was one of them. William Short was another. James Monroe was a third to a certain limited respect. Even James Madison was one of my pupils. So this is a subject of the greatest joy to me. First of all, you need to learn Latin and Greek. Start with Latin, a relatively simple language. It just takes discipline. Greek is somewhat harder, but anyone who puts his mind to it can learn enough Greek to read Homer and Plutarch and even Herodotus and Thucydides. And so if you're going to read in translation, which I assume most people in your time will do, the good news is there are outstanding translations in your time, much better than those that existed in mine. So a couple of titles that everyone should read. Everyone should read Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. These are the basic books of Western civilization, the greatest of all the books of the West. The Iliad is also arguably the first. I said it late in life that as my tastes narrowed with age, many things that I thought were fascinating as a young man ceased to be interesting to me as a senior citizen, but Homer remained. Secondly, you should read Plutarch, because Plutarch was the author of the Founding Fathers. If the Founding Fathers had to jettison every other classical author and keep just one, that one would have been Plutarch. Plutarch wrote lives of eminent Greeks and eminent Romans. They were parallel lives, and he drew comparisons in leadership styles between different figures, Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar, for example. And his lives of Solon, of Lycurgus, of Mark Antony, of Julius Caesar, of Brutus, of Cicero, of Cincinnatus, those lives of eminent Greek worthies and Roman orators, politicians, and soldiers are of almost incalculable importance in understanding the American Revolution and the way in which people like George Washington self-fashioned their character and their style in the manner of the heroes of Plutarch. So I would certainly recommend that. As to philosophy, if you are part of Western civilization and you have not read Virgil's Aeneid, you have done yourself a grave disservice. It is arguably, outside of the Bible, the most important book in the history of Western civilization, and no good translation exists of it, but there are plenty of translations, and I would recommend to everybody listening that you make an attempt at reading Virgil's Aeneid in Latin if you can, but in the best English translation you can obtain otherwise. And then finally, Tacitus. Tacitus was a late Republican, early Empire Roman historian. He was extraordinarily lucid and epigrammatic in his style. We get the word tacit from Tacitus, meaning never use two words where one will serve. And he was so severe about not using more words than necessary that at times his famous prose histories are a little bit hard to follow. But Tacitus's emphasis was what can go wrong in a republic. When a republic begins its collapse and makes inevitable an empire, and in empire there is security but no liberty, there is despotism but there is no longer any republic. And his books, the Annals and the Histories, are really probably the most important corrective that we can possibly have to any complacency we might feel about the longevity of our republic. If we wish to remain a republic, we're going to have to be so self-disciplined that it will be unprecedented in human history. And if you want to see what can go wrong, there is no book, ancient or modern, which tells the story of a republic in its death throes better than Tacitus.
Very good, Mr. President. You are most generous with your advice. I hope that Mr. Pope will take time to listen to your response and keep us abreast of his progress.
I wish that also. I hope that everyone listening who would like to know the classical antecedents of modern civilization will give some time to the books that I have mentioned. This can be done in 5 or 6 months of disciplined reading.
Perhaps one more question, Mr. President?
Certainly, sir.
This one comes from Sandra Godwin, and she's interested. I apologize. It's political in nature, but she wants to know about the midnight appointments of President John Adams. Not a happy time for you, sir. She writes that she knows John Adams appointed John Marshall to the Supreme Court as one of his last acts prior to leaving office. And she says, I believe Mr. Marshall assumed his position on January 31st, 1801. Is that correct?
Yes.
She wants to know if Mr. Marshall was confirmed by the Senate. Now, during our time, a president appoints a Supreme Court judge, and then the Senate gives its consent.
That happened then, too. So John Marshall is a cousin of mine, a distant cousin. We're both from Virginia. The difference is that he's a Federalist, and I am a Republican. And he is a believer in an energetic national government, and I prefer a weaker national government and stronger state and local governments. And Marshall believes that the Constitution should be broadly, fluidly interpreted to make it what's often called a living, flexible document, and I am more rigid. I want the Constitution to be literally, narrowly, carefully interpreted so that we don't do things in government that we're not enumerated for us by the Founding Fathers and the state constitutional ratification conventions. And so Marshall and I are two Virginians who could not see the world more differently. He disliked me, thought that I was a sort of a loose cannon and a Jacobin, a kind of a radical, Frenchified social philosopher who probably should be kept away from the helm on the ship of state, and I looked on Marshall as almost a, well, I have to say, a man who committed treason against the Commonwealth of Virginia. I can understand a New England Federalist, a New Hampshire Federalist, or a Massachusetts Federalist, or a Connecticut Federalist, but a Federalist in the Commonwealth of Virginia, it's a form of heresy.
You did get a bit radical at times, Mr. Jefferson.
That may be so, but radical means going to the roots. And radical means that the people are sovereign and they have a right to govern themselves in any way they choose. And whenever any form of government ceases to pay attention to the people, no matter if the people are wise or unwise, that government has become a tyranny, and the people have a right to rise up and take back their sovereignty and overthrow their government and throw the rascals out and shake things up. And in fact, the people should do so from time to time just to remind their leaders, so-called, that those leaders exist to serve the people and not the other way around. If that's radical, I fully accept it. As you know, I like a little rebellion now and then. It's as important in the political arena as thunderstorms are in the natural world. And I said the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. That is its natural manure. If that seems radical to you or to anyone else, I must accept it because that's the record of my actual thoughts on the sovereignty of the people.
Mr. President, we need to take a break in just a moment, but before we do, I want to go to the second part of Sandra's question, which was, in my time, sir, there was a president who, sadly, a Supreme Court justice passed away 11 months before this president's term ended. He made a recommendation as to the next Supreme Court justice, and the Senate refused to even consider them. How would you react to that?
The president has a right to surround himself with the people of his own political outlook. He has a right to appoint to the court system anyone he chooses. If that person is qualified, the Senate's duty is to confirm. The Senate is not empowered to decide whether they like the politics of the nominee or the president. The Senate's only interest is to determine the fitness in intellectual background, in administrative capacity, in discipline of mind of that candidate, and not to confirm a qualified person for the Supreme Court or any other federal court is a fundamental breach of the constitutional intention of advice and consent.
And yet this president allowed the Senate to have their way.
Well, there's not much that a president can do about it under the separation of powers doctrine. If the Senate refuses to confirm, nobody in the world can force the Senate to do so. That's the nature of the balance of power provisions of our Constitution.
Mr. President, I thank you so much for coming to visit us and answer these few questions today.
And don't get me started on midnight appointments, sir.
I will not, sir. I know better. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Jefferson and your weekly conversation with the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the man who portrays President Jefferson, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. And it was great to have you do your magical twist and become Jefferson and answer those questions. Thank you, sir.
I don't think we've ever done that before, where we're going along out of character and suddenly you ask me to suit up.
And you did well.
You know, and let me just say, suiting up in a barn. Yeah, not the best place, really.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
We got this great question from Sandra Godwin about midnight appointments, and I kind of knew where she was going. It was like, well, they did this to this president when they did it to you. But I'm always hesitant to bring up John Marshall and midnight appointments when I talk with the president because it's not a happy time for
Jefferson
him.
Was elected in the autumn of 1800, and Adams was clearly sent home. But Jefferson didn't take office until March of 1801. And in the interim between the time when the election results were known and Jefferson's installation on the 4th of March, Adams packed the court system with known enemies of Jefferson, including one of the midnight appointments, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, who disliked Jefferson and distrusted Jefferson and thought Jefferson was a bit of a ninny. And so Jefferson took this personally, and his view was, look, the people spoke. They discredited Adams and made him a one-term president. They elected me. So why, if there are these vacancies, would Adams put in people that are my sworn political enemies when he could have left those positions open for me to fill, or at least he could have filled with people who were completely nonpartisan and simply qualified? So when Jefferson and Abigail Adams got into their exchange in the spring of 1804, so Jefferson's daughter Maria dies. Abigail Adams had known her in England. She loved the young woman. And even though Abigail Adams now regarded Jefferson as an enemy, she wrote him a letter of condolence saying, even though I don't like you, don't trust you, have lost almost all my respect for you, yet I see that your daughter has died, and I just can't help but reach out to you with a letter of condolence. And so what a beautiful thing for her to do, although she didn't, I suppose, have to use all those angry prefaces. So Jefferson gets the letter, and he writes back and thanks her. And then he says, you know, now that you bring it up, One thing and one thing only that your husband did still kind of upsets me, and that's the midnight appointments, because the people had spoken. Why would he pack the judiciary with life-tenured people who were sworn enemies of the very thing that I was trying to do for the country, what I call the Second American Revolution? So she writes back. Now she's upset. She's really upset, and she says, look, buddy, the Constitution makes my husband, John Adams, president until March 4th, 1801. He made those appointments before March 4th, 1801. He has every constitutional right to make them. What are you saying, that the sitting president shouldn't fill vacancies just because he's going to be a one-term president? That would be to put the country into a real paradox, and we need to fill these offices. You're wrong. My husband had every right to name the people of his choice as long as they're confirmed by the Senate, and they were. And so Jefferson kind of lets it go at this point, but she was right and he was wrong. So was Obama right. So Obama has a vacancy. It's not his fault that Scalia died. He needs to fill that vacancy. He chooses somebody who has very high rankings from the ABA and so on. And the Republican Congress, Senate, refuses to even discuss that person's nomination during the last 11 months of the Obama administration. Obama was right. Senate Republicans were wrong. John Adams was right. Thomas Jefferson was wrong. You can't vacate your public responsibilities merely because an election has occurred. And in Obama's case, that election hadn't even occurred. It was one of the worst violations of basic constitutional niceties in modern American history. And then when President Trump became president, he nominated another very able person. And look what happened. After a short debate, he was duly confirmed as the Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. That's precisely how it should occur.
So your point is the system works even when people have bad manners about doing it. I've got a challenge for you, sir. Can we buzz through these?
Just let's see if we can do a few in quick time.
Yeah, Gary Gerken, what would Jefferson advise a representative or senator regarding the interests of their constituents versus the interests of the nation as a whole? Well, I think that's a pretty obvious answer.
Jefferson always thought that your first duty was to your constituents because you're their agent. And yet, if you disagree with them, if you have a commonwealth view that's at odds with those of your constituents, you should freely admit it. And you should say, I know that the great majority of you are for X. And as your agent, I suppose I should represent that X. But I happen to think that you're wrong. I know things you don't know, or I think you're being hasty. And so I'm going to vote for Y, but I'm freely telling you why I'm doing so. And I'm inviting you to repudiate me at the next election if you think that I'm no longer an adequate representative. In other words, I'm going to take the risk of believing that as your statesman, I sometimes should not do what you want me to do because of what might be a broader perspective or a deeper insight. But I do understand that by deviating from your will, I've made myself vulnerable. And if you choose to punish me, I will freely admit that you have the right to do so. Well, you don't hear much of that, do you?
No. Here's one that was kind of for me. James Kenyon, who talks about a while ago, David Swensen named a favorite album by Bob Dylan. I did not.
But you mentioned your love of Dylan.
Well, we talked about Dylan. I think you sucked me into it. But
he won the Nobel Prize for Literature,
what it
of all
was.
Things.
Yeah, anyway, so.
Really?
Really.
The Nobel Prize for Literature, Hemingway, Steinbeck, Faulkner. Oh, Dylan.
Come to this century, sir.
Dylan.
Absolutely.
The Nobel Prize for Literature belongs to people with an extensive works of deep examinations of the human condition.
You're just setting me up to pick a fight, aren't you?
Yeah, you go right ahead. Dylan is, I admit.
Let me ask you, have you read Dylan?
Yes, I have listened to him and read him. Not all of him. I haven't read
any,
all of Faulkner either.
Yeah,
Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, buddy.
That's a good one.
That's all I got.
Anyway, there was no favorite album, but I believe that there was a, if you want to check it out, go back to the jeffersonhour.com, and I think there's a Spotify list with a few favorites. You were picking like your favorite tune.
Give Dylan the Medal of Honor, but don't give him the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yeah, I hope you get some mail.
Thanks, of course.
James Kenyon, thank you very much. And lastly, we got a letter, because it's about time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
It is.
We got a letter from Christopher Ursich.
Yes.
He wrote to me and he said, have you ever considered selling T-shirts or other, quote, merch as fundraisers for the Jefferson? Yeah, and we have. We've thought about doing T-shirts and doing maybe coffee mugs. He says, how about I Believe in the Barn hoodie, or it was a bobcat T-shirt.
It was a bobcat. It was not a bobcat. You did not see a bobcat.
You're hard on me this week. Anyway, we're thinking about that. We're trying to figure out a way. We really don't have the infrastructure to handle that.
We need a capitalist.
Anyway, if you are interested in that, let us know, because it might push us over the top. And with that, sir, it's been a delightful conversation. Well, most of it this week. And it is now time for a hard rain to fall.
It is a little bit of a hard rain.
So welcome to this week's Jefferson Watch.
Students at Columbia University recently put a Ku Klux Klan hood over the statue of Thomas Jefferson that stands before the journalism school. The group, known as Mobilized African Diaspora, or MAD, declared that, quote, Jefferson's statue makes it clear that black students are merely tokens of the university. Matt argued that, quote, venerating Jefferson validates rape, sexual violence, and racism, which they say is at odds with the university's pledge to provide a safe and inclusive environment for all. They are demanding the removal of the repugnant statue of the author of the Declaration of Independence, the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty, and the Bill for the Government of the Western Territories. So let me get this straight. Jefferson must go because he was a slaveholder, but Alexander Hamilton gets to stay at Columbia, even though he despised democracy, distrusted the people, sought to overturn the election of 1800 after the New York results were in, called the United States Constitution a shilly-shally thing, envisioned a hereditary monarchy for the United States, wanted U.S. senators to serve for life, and believed that adventuresome militarism was a primary path towards American glory. Hamilton attended Columbia, then known as King's College, before he became history's greatest advocate for handing over America to what he called the rich and the well-born. A KKK hood over Jefferson's head at one of the premier academic institutions of the United States? Columbia, I thought you taught your students to think, to discuss, to reflect, to ponder, to debate, to imagine, to explore, rather than merely to posture in righteousness. Really? The students of Columbia are now joining the new American culture of outrage? I thought Columbia was above cliché. Here are five reasons that this is a bad idea. First, if you cover Thomas Jefferson with a KKK hood, what's left for the KKK? There's a proportionality issue here. Jefferson did some ignoble things, but he never burned crosses on the lawns of his enemies. He never turned attack dogs loose on black men accused of a crime. He never burned down the barns of Catholics and Jews in Virginia. He never sent thugs to beat up individuals who called for general emancipation. He never set fire to polling places, tortured prisoners, or joined a squad of sheeted goons on horseback who ran down a black man accused of a crime he may or may not have committed, then tied him to a tree, gouged out his eyes, castrated him with a butcher knife, and then poured kerosene on him and lit the pyre. For that matter, Jefferson never put a hood over the statue of someone he happened to disagree with. Second, there is no way we can erase the past. Slavery doesn't go away, even if you pluck down Jefferson's statue. Jefferson's life and achievement are inextricably bound up with slavery, but in this he is not alone. To be logically consistent, we'd have to burn images of George Washington, James Madison, James Monroe, John Marshall, Patrick Henry, and a range of others. Wipe them off the map, they and many more, but that doesn't change the fact that the United States was complicit in the systematic enslavement of millions of Africans and African Americans between 1619 and 1865, and our civilization has not achieved racial equilibrium even yet. I'd rather keep the Jefferson statue, and Robert E. Lee, and Stonewall Jackson, and Jefferson Davis, too, and talk about it, debate it, quarrel over it every day until we make things right, rather than rip them all down and pretend it never happened. Third, when J. Robert Oppenheimer was tried in 1954 for some radical associations he had formed during the 1930s, long before he was asked to head up the Manhattan Project, his countless defenders invoked what they called the whole man theory, taking Oppenheimer's life and achievement in their entirety, his degrees, his books, his teaching, his research in quantum mechanics, his masterful management of the most significant engineering project in American history, his mentoring of young scientists, his ethical musing on America's role in creating the greatest weapon of mass destruction the world had ever seen. Given all of that, how much weight should we give to one or two minor incidents that did no harm to America's security, but did not exhibit Oppenheimer in the best possible light? Taking Jefferson's life and achievement in their entirety, what weight should we give to slavery? If we apply the whole man theory, does his complicity in enslavement enforce us to erase him from Mount Rushmore, to raise Monticello, to throw paint on his statue at the College of William and Mary, to rename Jefferson High Schools for somebody better? Or on balance, do we still need, respect, and even celebrate Jefferson, in spite of slavery and Sally Hemings, for the long list of his undeniable contributions to American civilization, from the Library of Congress to the University of Virginia? Surely, he can never again be seen as a flawless American hero. But to make him a leering, raping, horsewhipping fiend like Harriet Beecher Stowe's Simon Legree is as silly as it is easy for those who would rather dismiss than discuss the blemishes of American history. Fourth, what makes these students believe they are morally superior to Thomas Jefferson or any number of other figures from American history? What part of the human condition they think they have avoided? I'm with Jesus. He who is without sin, let him cast the first stone. All you have to do is get off your soapbox long enough to ask, what will the future say of us? And then you just want to shrink away to your fracking rig, or your air-conditioned Walmart in Phoenix, or your spring break in Cabo, or your plastic water bottle, or perhaps remove your clothing made in Taiwan or China under labor conditions we have not permitted in this our happy republic since 1900. Really? We can be righteous, we who have caused the great majority of the world's scientists to warn that we are edging close to global climate catastrophe. I'm with Hamlet. Use every man after his desert, and who shall escape whipping? Finally, and most important, a mature response to the dark side of human behavior is not to turn away in smug superiority and disgust, but to wrestle with those impossible questions of human imperfection. Why did LBJ jeopardize his magnificent vision of a great society to wage war in Southeast Asia, a war he knew was unwinnable the moment he inherited it? LBJ's decision left 58,000 American dead, a million or more Vietnamese, and had he said from the beginning, the war could not possibly be won. Just for a moment, compare that with Jefferson's admittedly damaging relationship with slavery. Why did FDR put more than 120,000 Japanese, many of them Japanese Americans, in internment camps during World War II? How could Martin Luther King, who delivered one of the handful of greatest speeches in the 20th century, have plagiarized his doctoral dissertation? How could Theodore Roosevelt, America's greatest conservationist, have shot his way through almost the entire great chain of being? The list goes on and on. Shakespeare said, "We are all men frail and capable of frailty." George Washington told his niece Nellie, "There is something combustible in human nature, so we ought not to play with the matches of temptation." We humans are strange, paradoxical, and wayward creatures, full of sound and fury, and whopping darkness and self-destruction. Huck Finn said, "Human beings can be awful cruel to one another." Who shall escape whipping? Not I, that's for sure. My great mentor Everett C. Albers always said in moments like this, "Judgment is easy, understanding is hard." Amen. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.